no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a cop.
It's just me and you.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging. Mostly because there's no grass on the golf course, but there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I love the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trashy.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome back to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. This is episode 79. I'm your host, Alex Dixon. First thing I want to cover in the intro, and we'll make it brief, is you may have seen on your Beltway Golfer feed a new podcast, a new format that doesn't label a guest, doesn't label kind of an interview. Launched a second podcast that, at least for the time being, is going to be on the Beltway Golfer feed, called Surrender Birdies. And it's moving away a little bit from what I've been doing here on the Beltway Golfer Podcast for the last close to 4 years now, which is strictly kind of sit down conversations or interviews with interesting people in the world of golf around the greater DMV in the Mid-Atlantic, but bring a co-host on and potentially different, you know, co-hosts and guests as the show progresses, but more casual conversations and telling stories and jokes and news that we've learned since the previous episode about golf courses and goings on in the world of golf around the DMV, and telling tales and anecdotes from maybe golf rounds and what's going on just in the world of golf. So more of a casual conversation with a regular co-host. Got a co-host, Josh Hafkin, who is excited to join and bring some enthusiasm to the podcast and a different viewpoint, which I'm excited to have him helping out and co-hosting. But it's the kind of show where, first of all, I hope you listen, I hope you enjoy, but the guests we may or may not have on, they're not going to be interviews. They are going to be anyone that wants to talk local golf and has some stories to tell or has some hot takes or just want to hop on and have a conversation, jump on the pod. Less so for people that are working in the golf world, because that'll be for the Beltway Golfer Podcast and interviews and more in-depth conversations, more just avid DMV golfers or Beltway golfers that want to come on and just rap about golf for a while. That's the premise of Surrender Birdies. The Surrender Birdies podcast, again, will stay on the Beltway Golfer feed for the time being. I might move it off once it gains some steam onto his own feed, to be determined. But in the meantime, I hope you check it out. Give me some feedback. The first episode's got a funny story from a recent invitation I had out to Belhaven Country Club and an interruption by a phone call from the wife that also involved the cops. And it was turned into a kind of a hilarious misunderstanding, almost a Three's Company episode if you're of a certain age. But it's going to be a lot of episodes like that. So if you do give a listen, give us some feedback. Subscribe, rate, all that fun stuff. It is called Surrender Birdies. Moving on, this episode. So we got episode 79, Beltway Golfer Podcast. We head out to PBDI Golf Club in, I'm going to butcher this, never verified the name of the town. I've always just called it iJamsville. I don't even know if that's a silent J. Just outside of Frederick, Maryland, PB Golf Club is celebrating their 25th anniversary. Opened up in 1999. And the sit down is with their head superintendent, Chris Navin, who has done a marvelous job of bringing PBDI really back to life and has got the course looking fantastic. And this podcast came about back in late November, early December. I happened to drive by, had some time, put the drone up in the air, and hadn't played PBDI in quite some time. And when I saw some of the footage through the, you know, my camera, my drone, I was kind of blown away by how good it looked. And when I brought the drone down, I was just sitting in my car flying the drone and I looked up and there was a gentleman on the first tee box kind of doing some work and he was talking to another gentleman and he just kind of had the look that I was like, you know what? I bet that's the superintendent. Got out of the car, went over and introduced myself. And sure enough, that was Chris, and reached back out and said, you know, I'd love to sit down and learn about what you're doing out there. And just so happens it comes off him winning an award from Golfdom magazine for the work that he's done at the course over the course of the last 8 years. Because as you may recall, if you're a local golfer and has played it a bunch, 8 or 9 years ago, PBDI was not in great shape when he came aboard. And it's been a long road, but it's looking fantastic. And just this past year, they got to host a U.S. Open local qualifier, which they're going to do again this year on May 8th, which is exciting. So jumped into all kinds of stuff with Chris. And then we drove around the golf course, showed me a lot of what he was doing, shot some video, and had a great time. So that is our episode. I'll stop yapping. We'll get to the conversation with Chris. Here it is, episode 79 of the Bellway Golfer Podcast with the head superintendent at PBDI Golf Club, Chris Navin. Enjoy.
All right, so we're sitting here. We're in the basement here of PBDI, a room I've never been in. So you guys use this room for like events and weddings?
Yeah, we have trainings down here. We've had some of the local companies use this as a training room down here with the TVs. Weddings, you know, to be a lounge for bridal party or groomsmen to get ready down here with the pool table and foosball. And there's TVs, tons of stuff that we could do down here. And we utilize it, yeah.
It's a good spot to do an interview. We're not having any background noise.
That's right.
So we're here with the head superintendent of PBDI Golf Club, Chris Nate.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Great.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Absolutely.
We're going to jump into a whole bunch of stuff. Truthfully, one of the reasons I was motivated to this podcast and the timing was, and we just kind of talked about it, when we first met, I was just out here in the parking lot. I threw the drone up in the air.
Yeah.
And you just happened to be right by the first tee box and we talked for a minute.
Doing a project.
And I hadn't played PBDI in quite some time. And once I got the drone footage up in the air,
yeah,
I was kind of like, holy shit, it's looking great. It looks awesome.
Yeah.
A lot of just like the bunker work and it's been a while since I played it. I was like, oh man, PBDI is great.
Yeah.
And then I came back out and played the course just a couple weeks ago. And that just reaffirmed what I thought watching the drone video and when I posted the drone video on social media, got a ton of awesome feedback.
Oh, that's great.
People were like,
thank you for posting it.
Yeah. So I figured it'd be great to sit down with you and learn about what's been going on with the club and all the work that you've put into it since you became superintendent.
Yeah, 8 years ago, just over 8 years ago.
And where we'll start is then as I was doing a little bit of research on you, congratulations, you just won an award from Golfdom Magazine.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
For those that don't know, Golfdom Magazine, does the Golf Course Superintendent Association put out that magazine?
No, they're a separate publication. Golfdom's been around for a long time. Herb Graffis was one of the original, and the award is named after, you know, him because of all he's done. He was the founder of Golfdom, and he was on the Golf Writers Association of America. He founded a lot of the journalism, or was on the ground floor of a lot of the journalism that went on, you know, 100 years ago when golf was, you know, back in the golden era, you know, and he was friends with Robert Trent Jones. And I had the opportunity to meet Reese Jones at the GIS show a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, he said Herb Graffis and his dad were good friends. I mean, we're talking again, this is the who's who of golf course architecture. I mean, some of the best clubs in the world are designed after these people. And, you know, to kind of have that connection with history and to be able to receive this award, it was great for the club. The recognition that the club was able to get, you know, beautiful article written about everything that we've done here and just really highlighted all the hard work that went into it. So, yeah, it was shocking. You know, it's a career change for me. So to make this career change and then to kind of be recognized in a major publication, a national publication like that was very special. Very special.
Cool. We'll get into the career change here in a minute.
Yeah.
So what? Tell the listeners that aren't familiar with the award, like, what is the award? You know, why did you get it?
So it's the Herb Graffis Business Person of the Year Award. Okay. And what it looks at is superintendents who really, it's not all about agronomics. It's not all about, you know, the best golf course. It's all about, you know, the entire, everything that surrounds the superintendent's position. Whether it's business, whether it's agronomy, whether it's people management, whether it's, you know, interactions with golfers. And they do a phenomenal job of taking, you know, all the names that they get, all the nominations that they get, and really looking at you know, who best fits this award for them, because it's their award of the year.
Sure.
You know, it's their big award. And, you know, just going back through the history of who's received it, it's like, this is a big deal, because some of the names, all the names that are on there, you know, very, very worthy. And, you know, so it is, it's the, you know, everything that encompasses the position. It's not just about growing grass. That's a small percentage of
right.
it.
So I imagine a big part of what we're going to talk about today, and I imagine this all went into obviously winning this award, is you came onto this job, and we'll get to the career change.
But sure.
You started what year?
2016.
And PB Dye and Golf Club in like 2014, 2015, how would you describe the course?
Well, it was described to me when I first saw the position open up. A good friend of mine, Andrew Harrison, I first saw the position open up. I was at Bully Rock, and I was ready. I was ready. I felt like I was ready to make a move and get my own course. And I saw it open up. It was within the state of Maryland, so it wasn't a crazy move. I know the area when it comes to growing grass in the Mid-Atlantic. And I asked him, I said, well, tell me about PBDI. And he said, it's dead. And I'm like, okay, what's dead? You know, dead is used loosely in our world. You know, dead means it can come back. But no, this was dead. I mean, there was a lot of dead grass out there. It was down to dirt, sand. So that's the way it was described to me. And it was, you know, it was a turnaround. It really was. You know, I toured the property. I came out here on my own several times just to walk around and get an idea of what needs to be done here, because I really wanted the job. Because at that point, ownership was, you know, 100% committed. Even after all the failures and all the money lost the years prior, ownership was still 100% committed to having their golf course back. And through all of the trees and all of the junk and all of the dead grass, you could see the bones of the property were there. Mm-hmm. And I got excited, even though I knew it was a hell of an undertaking in front of me. And, you know, agronomically, I did well at Rutgers. I felt like I was ready to go, but you don't know you're ready to go until you're actually on your golf course, because that's where 90% of your knowledge comes from, is right. each specific property.
So some of the, I read this in one, I admit this might have been the article in Golfdom that I spouted of this, but these are some things about the Golf Club when you took over, when we're talking about how the course was struggling at the time.
Sure.
Back into it. 25% of the greens were unusable because of dead surfaces. 30% of the fairways were dead. The green surrounds were thin with poa that wouldn't survive the summer months at all.
No.
And that was the predominant turf type through like 75% of the course, right?
Yeah, it was pretty bad. You know, when you have thin turf, poa moves it, and poa does not like the summer months.
Got it.
Yeah.
So when you came in, where did you start? Where did you begin?
Well, it all begins with your greens. You know, I mean, if you don't have good greens, you're not going to have a good client. You know, people coming through the door and saying good things. So we started focusing on the greens. A lot of, you know, some of these areas were unusable, not because the whole area was dead, but because it was very patchy. So we were able to start plugging, you know, and plugging these areas out. And then once those plugs heal, you know, we were able to get those areas usable again. So that was a lot of it early on was, you know, hey, look, we had a whole chipping green that we were able to start taking plugs from, and we started fixing areas, and we went green by green, plugged, did what we could do. Then we started seeding into it and just letting the seed kind of take over and grow. The nice thing about poa is it does come back. So with a plan in place, we were able to kind of get that poa through the first year. Everywhere else, it was just time, letting the bent grass grow, reseeding where we had to. We did no projects year one. My number one goal, the only goal of year one, was don't let grass die. And year one was a hell of a year. It was dry. It wasn't as dry as this past year in 2023, but for a golf course that everything was shit. The soil was horrible. Turf was horrible. Turf was stressed. Trees were everywhere. There was shade. There were roots. There were tons and tons of problems. We got through the year with very minimal damage. I would say 99% of the golf course got through it. So going into that fall, you know, again, we were still focusing. I was still learning the property. No projects. You know, we were just, let's get through the whole year. We'll grow it back. Went into 2017. And from then on, 2017 was still very, very early in my years here, but 2017 weather was, I've been here 8 years. It was the easiest year for growing grass that I've had here. Gotcha. It just, the rain came at perfect times. It was never super hot, you know, and we just kind of got through that year and it propelled us. And then that's when we started a lot of the projects.
backing up, like,
sure,
you know, because it sounds like what you just described more than anything was attention.
Yeah.
And making sure that it wasn't, you know, the grass wasn't dying. So
yeah,
how did it get, you know, this was before you were here, but how did it get to the point where it was? Was it just a lack of attention or lack of management or just bad weather?
Probably all the above. It was, you know, there was a weedy grass in the turf that's called goosegrass. And it's not, and it does, it's just the name of it. It has anything to do with geese. And it spreads fast because it produces hundreds, if not thousands of seed every year. Well, all those seeds are viable the next year. The plant dies off, but you take one plant that produces 500 seeds. And now you got 500 new plants the next year. So the hard thing is once that kind of moves in, it continues to move in, especially if you don't have a management plan for it. And there wasn't a management plan. So what led to all the dead turf, from what I've heard, was in 2015. There was a dry stretch in 2015, and there was a product applied, you know, mid to late summer, two or three times to what he thought was going to kill the goosegrass, and it didn't. It's not even labeled for goosegrass, but what it killed is everything else because you're applying an herbicide on stressed turf. So it really went into, you know, just tons of dead grass on tees and approaches and other areas of the golf course that really had to be, you know, fixed in a hurry.
Yeah.
You know, you can't have 18 sets of tees that are just nuked, right, you know, down the sand. So
you think that's the most common thing, like for the average golfer who, you know, sees a course, you know, maybe it's the local course they play every so often, you know, have a year like that where they're struggling with maintenance. Is more time than not a story like that where it's a user error where maybe something, a wrong chemical was applied?
It, a lot of times, because, you know, it's, again, growing grass in Mid-Atlantic is not easy. It's a tough environment for whether you want to grow Bermuda or you want to grow bent grass.
I've heard that from a few people. Is that just the compacted soil and the hardness?
It's the weather. Okay. It's the weather. You know, when you have winters where you can have winter, that makes it hard to grow Bermuda. When you have summers that you can have 94 degrees, weeks on end, humidity, weeks on end, 78 degree nights, weeks on end, then your cool season grasses struggle. So it's a very tough area no matter what you're trying to grow. There's a lot of advancement in science. But yes, it goes back to applying the wrong product at the wrong time. And you know, there's a lot of great superintendents out there who have applied the product at the wrong time and it costs them. And, you know, it's just a simple mistake of maybe you think it's good for it or maybe it's not. I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into it, you know, but a lot of places, you know, the mistakes that are made can ultimately ruin you in one shot. And that's the hard thing. You know, it's a hard thing. When you're maintaining properties where people expect it good, great, year after year, day after day. And, you know, I always tell everybody, I'm out of control. I'll be the first one to blame Mother Nature when something goes wrong. And I'll be the first one to say, I had nothing to do. I'm just riding that Mother Nature train. If she's giving me good weather, I'm going to do what I know I need to do to keep promoting plant health. If she's giving me a hard run, I'm going to do what I know that I think I need to do to get it through to when weather improves.
Yeah.
And you know, there's zero control out there. You're just taking what people have found out over the years, whether it's universities or scientists or other superintendents. You're just taking all that word of mouth and learning. And that's why we had the seminar yesterday, you know, to hear some of the latest and greatest research that's out there. You know, it's you just take all that information and do the best you can to get from, you know, pick a date, Memorial Day to Labor Day, some say 4th of July to, you know, late September. You know, that's what we do.
How about jumping around a little bit here?
Sure.
How much does the winter, like take this winter, for example.
Sure.
How much does that, you know, the harshness of the winter or the warmness of the winter impact the playing months?
There's two ways to look at it agronomically. If it's cold, you know, you can get turf to get into a deep, deep state of dormancy. If it's warm, the turf really never goes into a deep, deep state of dormancy, and it's always active. So, you know, you kind of like to see the deep state of dormancy because, you know, that plant hardened off, went into winter, you know, it's got its carbohydrate reserves for the whole winter to get through it. But if you got a warm winter where it's kind of staying active, you know, that plant never really went to sleep.
Gotcha.
Now,
that's a negative.
That's a negative. That's a negative. And plus with warm weather on top of that, you know, you got play. Right. And, you know, when it's busy. And the divot that's there in November is going to be there in April. Because even though that plant might still be active, it's warm. It's not growing. It's just active. You know, it might be green and it's doing its thing, photosynthesis, but it's not really growing to fill in those divots. So if you're busy, you know, the divots and the damage that's done throughout, you know, November, December, January, February, into March, grass starts to wake up. Sometimes you're trying to grow in a pretty banged up area just because the amount of play that you've had.
Right. Interesting. Well, let's back up a minute. Let's get into that career change that you kind of mentioned.
Okay.
So you mentioned Rutgers. Did you study this?
At Rutgers. Yes. Yep.
But then you became a school teacher.
Okay. Well, school teacher was first. You know, you get done with high school and you're 18 years old and you got to pick a career. Got to pick a career and go to college. Okay. I didn't know, but I'm like, yeah, teaching. At least I could still work on a golf course or play golf in the summers. You know, because I love golf. I worked on a golf course back when I was 15 years old doing exactly what I do now. I was the grunt. And, you know, so, a lot of superintendents almost all of them, this is how they go. So they realize how important those positions are. And I was that position. I was the guy getting into things that nobody else really got into. And I loved it. So I was at Huntsville Golf Club in Northeast PA for 7 years, seven summers. Came back every year. You know, they couldn't get rid of me. And then I finished college with a teaching degree, elementary ed. I subbed up in PA a year. I coached football, I coached baseball, and I didn't get a job that year, but I had an opportunity in Maryland. So we moved to Maryland in August of 2006 and lived over in Harford County. I taught fifth grade in Harford County Public Schools for 5 years. And then I transferred to another school and I taught fourth grade for a year. All the time, those summers, I worked at Maryland Golf Country Club in Bel Air, Maryland, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
During that stretch, was it in your head where you were going to be a teacher for the rest of your life?
Well, year one and two, I was like, yeah, I love teaching. You know, you're young and you're into it, and then you start getting, like, seeing the problems with it. And, you know, I was kind of by year three, I'm like, phew, I'm not doing this forever. You know, and I was, you know, almost done with a master's. I was, you know, in administration, and I was, here I am, like, I'm going to bail. And I said, you know, finally after, you know, I want to transfer in year five. So I did. I didn't want to bail completely, but I'm like, I got to transfer and see if it's just the school I'm in.
Yeah.
And I love the school I was in, you know, and when I transferred schools, it was like, oh, that ain't it. I still hate this. So there were some things that happened in that last year where it made it clear to me that this isn't for me. And so there was a date in July where I had to resign by, and, you know, this is how, and at this point I'm accepted to Rutgers. I was ready to go. I was coming on full time at Maryland Golf Country Club, you know, and just to kind of do my internship and get through school.
How old are you at this point?
Now I'm 40. At this point I was 30, 28, okay. 29, 30, somewhere in there.
You're doing summers, but you essentially went to Rutgers to get your master's.
Yeah. No, not master's. I went to their professional management of turf grass school.
Okay.
The beauty of that program is you go, it's 10 weeks, it's a full-time job. You're there every day, you know, 8:30 to 3:30, 4 o'clock, and then you got to study. There's a lot of studying you got to do. But all of the classes are hyper-focused on golf turf with a little bit of sports turf, but mostly golf turf. Yeah. So you're not in a soils class with a bunch of geology students or construction guys or engineers who are talking about compaction to build a 500-foot skyrise. No, we're talking about, you want more compaction when you're talking about that. For us, we want to talk about ways to alleviate compaction. And that is the beauty of the Rutgers program, is we were really able to focus on, you know, in our soils classes, what do you got to do to make soil good for growing a green, growing tea, or anything on the golf course? So, yeah.
Pretty much everybody in this program are folks that want to become golf course.
Yeah, they want to work in the golf industry. Yeah.
Where I was going with that last line was at age 28 or 30, is that about the average age in that class, or are you on the older end?
I was kind of in the middle. There were guys older than me, and there were guys younger than me, you know, but they were all... The common thing with that program was everybody has worked on a golf course. And now they want to just make a career out of it. You know, some worked on it for a year. At that point, I was 13 years on a golf course, you know, and just working as a summer guy. And but, you know, I fell in love with it. And there's a lot of things to fall in love about it. And, you know, the one thing they told us up at school was, you know, if you love the maintaining of the golf course, some of you are in for a rude awakening, because when you kind of, when you go into this position, the maintaining of the golf course really kind of takes a back seat to all the business side of it. So there's a lot more, yeah, you're focused on the golf course, but there's other guys who are out there doing the mowing, and there's other guys who are out there doing whatever that makes a golf course a golf course. You're just kind of overseeing all of it. And so you kind of have to put that love of sitting on a mower aside. I still try to sneak on one every once in a while when I know I have time and I can go out and mow a green or mow something. But
so when we're talking about the business side of it, I know a part of it is something you were talking to me a little bit about upstairs before we started recording, and that's, you know, all the ordering of equipment and all that. And I imagine that's also only a small part of it. You're also managing a team and payroll.
Payroll, all that stuff. And especially with, you know, again, this is why we have our education that we do. And like I said, the Mid-Atlantic Superintendent Association just put on a hell of a conference yesterday. And we had a great lineup of speakers. And we learned a lot that there's changes coming, you know, and that's the biggest thing, is keeping up with all the different changes that are going on, all different research, you know, and then that goes off into pesticides, or that goes off in fertilizer, or that can go off into equipment, or that can go off into just your general watering practices. There's so many different ways that education can go, and it's kind of ironic. I'm the, you know, I was a teacher, and here I am the education chair for our chapter now, and, you know, I love it. I mean, education to me, I think, is very important. It's very important so we can all grow and do better at what we do, especially in something that's so science driven. And research changes. I mean, there's stuff that when I started 8 years ago here, that research has changed even by now. You know, and it's makes keeps you on your toes.
So part of that business piece of it, and going back to kind of where we left off in the improvement of the golf course, we were around 2018 or so. You know, is a lot of that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine, do you get like a budget from management every year, like for the year, or is that a month-to-month basis? And where I'm going with this is, how does that impact how you make decisions on improving the course?
So we adopted here, you know, essentially a base zero budget. You don't have a number. You're not said, you're not told you only have $1 million for this year, or you're not told you only have $500,000 for this year. So what that allowed us to do is, because there were so many things wrong, we had to prioritize. You know, when we set up, you know, a real good program where I have like my tier one, which is like, it's broken or it's dead or there's problems. So, and really in year one, everything could have been tier one, but, you know, like even like tier one is everything that's like, for me now, is there's something wrong that we got to fix it. Tier two is like, it's on the radar, it's going to go wrong. And tier three is like a wish list item. Well, back then, like tier three stuff was like fixed bunkers that were completely failed. Now, like tier three stuff is stuff that really doesn't even have to do much with the golf course anymore. It's just more of the big picture stuff here. So, you know, we adopt a base zero budget. So it's, you know, it's not spend it or you lose it kind of thing. It's, we focus on what needs to be fixed and what needs to be done, and we just get it done. And that goes back to our ownership, who is 100% committed to improve, you know, and all along has been 100% committed to improving the property, but we kept it on a budget. It was very easy in year one. We could have spent $5 million and just be done, you know, but in that time, I never would have learned a golf course. You know, you never would have, you know, the ownership at that point beaten down for hundreds, if not millions of dollars in the years prior. So we, you know, we really wanted to prove to them that we could do this in-house and we could do this ourselves and we could do this without subsidizing and asking for money every single year. And we've proven that. And that's what made it, you know, really exciting for us. And we're very, very proud of it, of what we've been able to accomplish. So, yeah, I mean, my budget's increased over the years because obviously we've had more money with more play. But, you know, it's still, we adopt that only spend it if you need to. And we've added some things to improve conditions. But, you know, the biggest thing that we focus on over the last several years is just really focusing on improving what has been wrong on that golf course. Once we got grass healthy and it kind of ran itself, the focus turned into what really needed the elbow grease.
Can we talk about some of the projects and some of the great things that you've done out there? Whether it be, we'll start with grass. I think you replaced the grass, at least on the tee boxes. Is it still POA and for most of the course?
No, we've done a good job over the last several years of exploiting the bent grass growth. And, you know, early on, I was afraid to put a pre-emergent out going into late summer, because that's when you want to put it out to prevent new POA from germinating. But being that we were 50-50.
I don't know all the time. So pre-emergent.
So pre-emergent, you put that down on the soil to prevent new seed from germinating. So to get new plants in. So POA is an annual grass. You know, it goes through a struggle. A lot of times it dies. But the seed heads are still in the ground and they want to germinate. Well, early on, we were maybe 50-50. A lot of POA, a lot of bent grass. I didn't want to stop any new POA from coming in right away because God only knows what will be left. We'll go back to looking dead. And we're too close back then to the memory of being a dump. And so the goal was to always just get through. Don't ever make it look like, oh shit, PB dies back to old PB die again. Right. You know, and so that was a big focus and big goal early on. But then we got to a point where I noticed the tide started to change where we had more bent grass going into the fall. And then up until really 2 years ago, I was nervous to put pre-emergent on the greens in right around Labor Day for the new POA plants. And I did it. And now we have pretty much gotten to where we're 85, 90% bent grass on our greens just to keep that POA out. And that helps with a lot of pest stuff. You know, you're not struggling through the summer months nearly as much when we had mostly POA or a lot of POA. So yeah, we've done a lot with that and then interseeding here and there into things. So that was our biggest focus turf-wise is just let's get to what we know will do the best in our region. And with some of that, even the bent grass failed. That's why we have a lot of Bermuda out there now. And that's why you see a lot of those projects with the brown now, you know, they're tan as can be. And that's the Bermuda that we have.
Sure.
But those tees were tees that always struggled during the summer months because they were too dry or they're in a pocketed area of the golf course. So there was no airflow. And cool season grasses on those sticky 75 to 80 degree nights in the mid-Atlantic, cool season grasses really do struggle without airflow.
Am I wrong? It seems like there's a trend, a lot of golf courses in this area that have kind of been moving over to Bermuda.
Well, because the research that has been put into the Bermuda grasses has allowed that. 10 years ago, if you put Bermuda in, there was a better chance than not that you were going to struggle coming out of winter. Now, with the new cultivars that are out of Bermuda, and a cultivar is just Bermuda's Bermuda. That's the blanket grass. But inside, just like bent grass.
Like Tahoma 31.
That's a cultivar of Bermuda grass or like different bent grasses. You know, you have your old bent grasses and you have new ones like your 7007 or 777. Those are just cultivars, which is, this goes back to the research that, you know, and I've talked about this with Golfdom. They do a phenomenal job of covering everything from, you know, what we do at a golf course to the new research it's at. And the university has dumped tons of resources and time and effort into crossbreeding bent grasses to become more drought tolerant, heat resistant, insect resistant, which in turn allows you to cut back on pesticide use, which I think everybody, I mean, regardless of where you are in the country, everybody likes to cut back on pesticide use, whether it's for environmental reasons, which even the pesticide company has done a phenomenal job of, you know, becoming single site uses now. It's not a blanket treatment where you go send a insecticide out, an adulticide, and you really kind of take a lot of insects out, even your beneficials. Now you put something out and it's like, man, you're really only focused on your pests now. So yeah, so we've gone with Tahoma just because that is the latest and greatest grass that is doing phenomenal in northern climates. I think they have it on Soldier Field in Chicago. It's wild. And they grow it in the Midwest. It was developed at Oklahoma State. Well, you know, Oklahoma can get damn cold. But it does well in the summers there or in the winters there. And it loves heat and it grows. It's a Bermuda grass.
So right now that's primarily your tee boxes?
Or we have about probably over 100,000 square feet out there. We have it on a few approaches, but we have it mostly on tee boxes right now. And what helps with that is you keep it fed and you keep it happy. You know, you come back to it a week later and it's a carpet again. You know, so it allows you to move your traffic around. And by the time you're circling back around, you know, once you've taken a bunch of divots in an area, you come back around to that spot and it's like a carpet.
Let's talk about bunkers for a minute.
Sure.
One of the big things that really is noticeable, especially in that drone video I took, at, you know, so when the sun hits, when you get some shadows from a setting sun,
yeah,
is not just your bunkers, but the spots that used to be bunkers.
Yeah.
That really create this cool mounding.
Yeah.
And shadows.
Yeah.
So how many bunkers did you remove?
Oh, I mentioned it. I want to say, I think we removed over 30. Now, a lot of those, there were a lot of bunkers removed early on before I even got here. And then there's some places out there I thought it was a bunker and it never was. It was just mounding. You know, PB Dye, the mounding, I mean, he spent 180 plus days on site, and the man loves a bulldozer. And he moved and made all this mounting, which was, you know, funny early on in 2016. You know, he's like, you got to cut all the, can I curse? Sure. He's like, you got to cut all these fucking trees down. I spent 180 days on this place with a bulldozer, and all the fucking guy does is plant trees. And it's like, all right, you know, and it did. It blocked all the mounting. And if you got to meet PB Dye, you would, yeah, he's one of the greatest people that you could meet. He truly loves what he has done, and he loves what he has been around because of his dad with Pete and all the opportunities that has afforded him. And
how often does he come by?
Once a year, twice a year, he'll try to stop by. We'll talk more often. You know, he'll call me or I'll call him and just to catch up, and he wants to know how it's going.
I'm curious, do you feel when you remove a bunker that was likely put there by him as the architect, is that something that you feel obligated to run by him?
Well, I asked that early on because there were a lot of bunkers that were failed, and these failed bunkers weren't seeing a lot of play. So it's like, what's the point keeping a failed bunker that's a bunker?
Yeah.
When it'll be a hell of a lot easier just be able to mow over. So, you know, so we did remove a lot. And I asked him early on, and his biggest thing was, if you change a green, mm-hmm. you know, the contouring of greens, and you really do a green redesign, whether it's one or all, he said he wants to be a part of it. The layout of the hole, you know, how the hole might run.
Yeah.
He wants to be part of that. But when it came to adding tees or making tees bigger or changing some bunkers, you know, what we focus on is when it's a bunker that has a high impact on how that hole plays.
Yeah.
It forces you to make a decision.
Sure.
Those we've kept. Right. We've wanted to keep those. We may have changed maybe the shaping around it to make it work in that site, because there were some bunkers that were on a hill. So a heavy rain, all the sand washed down to the bottom. So what we've done in a lot of spots is split up a bigger bunker that's kind of on a slope and just made it a series of smaller bunkers, but we've kept the bunkers. Now we've got a lot of bunkers that really had no bearing on, people never even thought about them. Some people didn't even know they were there.
Yeah.
And we would remove those just to make them more of a grass hollow that kind of fits the site around it.
Imagine, does that, I mean, the more bunkers, it requires more maintenance, which
yes.
increases your budget.
Yes.
So removing bunkers that aren't getting any play or pretty far out of the way
yeah.
helps the bottom line too, right?
Our first year, when we started rolling into projects in second year, when we started rolling into projects late in 17, I think we removed 7 or 8 bunkers that year. And I just ran some very, you know, rudimentary numbers that were very basic, very just, here's what we do on a normal basis. Forget fixing them after a heavy rain, or forget, you know, a lot of things. But, you know, if you're just talking about string trimming the edges, raking the edges, we figured with those 7 or 8 bunkers that first year that we removed them, we saved about $1,500 just that year in labor.
Got it.
Yeah, and we've gone bigger than that now at that
point. I'm naive at this, but removing bunkers, I feel like I've seen removed bunkers that are not equal. You know, some are, can you talk about whether it's converting sand or removing all of it?
We move the sand out, and then if the site works where we could get a mower around it and through it, we won't really touch the shaping around it, because grass hollows, you know, they're nice on a golf. It goes back to the shadows.
Yeah.
They're nice on a golf course too. If the site doesn't work and it's still a pain in the ass to mow around it and keep that area maintained, what we'll do is we'll break down some of the mounting around it. Keep the mounting, but just break it down enough just to make it to where a mower can go up and over it.
Yeah.
And that's what we've done out there is kept the mounting. We don't want to make an area flat, because flat's boring.
Sure.
You know, especially in the morning or late in the day.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've softened those slopes to make it maintainable, so we're not scalping, or we can get the mowers up and over it, whatever we got to do. So, yeah, removing the sand is big. You can't put fescue on sand. That's something that doesn't work. Fescue doesn't grow on sand. You know, so we clean it all out, put some drainage in if we need to, break down the sides if we need to, and just resop, put the side over the top.
One of the signatures of the Dive family is the railroad tires.
Oh.
That was going to be my question. As a superintendent, do the railroad ties, how do they make your life? Sounds like harder based on that reaction.
Well, in August and September, you better have a can of bee spray. Because those yellow jackets, they don't like when you run that string trim right over their home. And they'll let you know. So, yeah, it's carrying a can of bee spray. And you know, we've learned to always keep an eye out, like, two or three railroad ties down as you're string trimming them. You know, we've kind of gotten away from that, the string trimming part of it, just because we like the more natural look. We've actually moved some little blue stems to kind of go in between our railroad ties now to give it more of a natural look.
I noticed that.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll string trim them in the spring, get them cleaned up and nice. We do it again in the fall, get them cleaned up and nice, and then we just let them go. And they're there, and you could see them, but we'll maintain them. We won't allow weeds to encroach. It'll just be more of like a nice native grassy area with the little blue stems coming out of the top. And we'll leave the little blue stems up through probably mid to late May. Right now they're brown, you know, but they're very nice. It just creates an interest in an area that, yeah, there's a lot of interest in the railroad ties. But back when we used to string trim, yeah, it was pain in the ass. It was a lot of getting chased by bees and there's a snake or whatever.
I imagine since that's kind of like a known Dive family thing,
yeah,
that's not one you can just remove without.
We've removed some. Again, some where guys were like, oh, we didn't even know there were railroad ties there because it's a part where you don't see them. But in other areas, you know, we want to keep them. We do, because it's a feature of the whole. I mean, look at 16.
Right.
You know, 16 is a prime example of railroad ties down the right hand side. Yeah. And then railroad ties.
I kind of forgot. I mean, I haven't played this course as frequently as I should have, but like in my, like two is what you always remember.
Yeah, right.
It's right there on the other side of the green.
Right.
You see it early. And when I played it a couple weeks ago, I was like, I forgot how many railroad ties are on
there. Yeah. So two is a lot. Two, and then 3T is right behind it with them. But then we removed some there. Yeah, because, again, the railroad ties are failing. They've been in the ground now for almost 25 years. You know, the course is open 25. This is our 25th anniversary this year.
Right.
So that means there's been railroad ties out there that have been in the ground for 26, 27 years from construction stage. So, you know, these railroad ties, they're rotten. I mean, there's not much left in spots. There's spots where they're completely gone.
So will they get replaced? Or
well, that's what we're trying to visit. The problem with railroad ties is you can't cut them. I mean, you can, but you have to use like a concrete saw because a chainsaw at the holes right away. There's sparks flying everywhere. All the shit that's in a railroad tie, sparks are flying everywhere. Okay. And you dull your blade in one cut and they're heavy. I mean, you and I aren't picking a railroad tie up. Like an 8-foot.
Even rotted ones that are.
Well, rotted ones are, yeah. But even some of those are heavy because now they're waterlogged. But the new ones that are going in, yeah. I mean, you have to have mini excavators on site to place them. And
gotcha.
We're not. I mean, so that's what I'm trying to figure out going forward.
Just let them die.
Well, some of them that we do want to replace, we've talked about doing, and I'm exploring this more and more because it's getting closer and closer and we have to replace them, using timbers, pressure-treated timbers. And to keep that look, and we could distress them with taking a torch to them or whatever we want to do to distress them, make them look distressed, or you can get them rough cut.
Yeah.
And just doing like a 3-inch or a 4-inch thick timber that's maybe, you know, a railroad tie width and replacing with that, because then it's just lumber. We could cut it with a chainsaw. It's a hell of a lot lighter, so we could move them around a lot easier. And then what we'll do is just create the cavity, put some stone behind it so it drains better and that piece of wood doesn't rot away as quick.
Right.
Yeah, so that's, I think, where we're going with going forward. I know people might not want to hear that because a lot of people hate the railroad ties, but a lot at the same time, I mean, it kind of make some holes too, at least frames those holes that are out there.
Right. Sticking with projects, what about tree removal?
Mm. So we've done a lot of trees. It goes back to that first conversation with PV Dye when he came on the site to cut all the trees down. We started early on, you can't have trees and turf. It just doesn't work. Either you have a golf course or you have trees. You can't have both. A lot of that is shade and a lot of that is root zone encroachment. Just because the tree's there, you know, the roots could be out 100 feet into a fairway.
Sure.
And this year we saw that again. We saw a lot of the edges of our fairways where there's trees nearby, like on 7, you know, the root zone, you can see where it is. It's a curved, you know, it's a circle in your fairway where that's where the root zone reached to. And that tree is going to draw the moisture out of the soil before the turf does.
You probably see that. I'm trying to think of the course that the tree that's closest in the fairway is maybe three.
That tree. Yeah, so that poplar. But, you know, that poplar is actually that root zone goes deep more. So we don't really have an issue there. It was more like where our oak trees were or any maples were. Okay. We had a big issue because those root zones are kind of on the surface more. And so they're closer to the root zone of the grass, you know, of your turf. So if that root from that tree is intermingling with the roots from the turf, that tree's going to win every time. So we just have some issues where root pruning works, but in some places, you know, our biggest thing is the trees are nice in spots. They frame the hole. They make you play the hole appropriately. But we want to do is look in an area where there's a lot of trees, and do we need all these big trees in this one little spot, or can we pick our healthiest ones and cut out the ones that are shaped weird, or maybe that'll be dangerous at some point, like if they're growing in like, you know, two trunks, those are an unsafe tree. So that was our biggest focus, is promote the healthy trees, keep the trees that are there healthy. You know, when you plant trees 20 years ago, 25 years ago, they all come as small little trees. Well, small trees get to be big trees quick when there's fertilizer and irrigation every year. You know, it's never dry and always fed. So a little 8-year-old tree becomes big in a very short amount of time.
I read somewhere you guys have done a lot. It seems like you've done a lot of bridge work too out there.
Yeah, we did last winter. This is the benefit of having phenomenal employees on staff who are retired. I mean, these guys are just, they love the club. Mm-hmm. They want to see success. A lot of them mow with me. And, you know, we had issues with the bridges on 14, 15, and 18, and 13, back over on 13T, where these bridges have failed. I mean, again, 25-year-old bridges. And, you know, so we wanted to replace the decking on them. And that's all we did. We just pulled up the old decking and put down the new.
Yeah.
The bridge on 7, 8, and the bridge on 2 are still in pretty good shape. So we're going to see if we get another year out of them, maybe try to do those next year.
How's the walkway on 11 holding up?
Oh, that I don't know what we're going to do.
I mean, which is maybe the most recognizable.
Yeah, that's a very, you know, that's the walk most people like to make, is across that pond. You know, again, there's a 25-year-old bridge that's actually been in water too for 25 years. So
when I walked it, I was like, it doesn't look like it's had much work recently.
No, it hasn't. It's weathered. I mean, it's still structurally sound. We have to just replace the matting on the top. Which, and that matting's expensive, but we'll do that this year. We replaced the steps on the green side. We're going to replace the steps on the carpet side this spring. We just put stone steppers in and kind of made it fit. But, you know, the bridge itself is structurally sound. It's just there's going to come a point when it's not. And you kind of want to be ahead of the curve on that one, because if that bridge fails, guess what? 11's closed. How the hell do you get out there? Right. So we got some pond work that we're going to be doing over the next few years. You know, some cleaning out of the sediment, and we're going to fix our drain and do a lot of things that, you know, and eventually we got to do the waiver ties around that green too.
Right.
You know, they're rotting it.
One thing I just remember from playing it the other day was, and I'm curious if this is a winter thing or this is your decision. It seemed like that hole 11, and there was at least one other green where it seemed like there was no fringe.
We get a lot of that too. So a lot of research out there now has said, if you can get away with not having a collar, do it. And not everywhere can do that. You know, you got greens.
That's the grass.
Yeah. Because, and there's thoughts in that, you know, a collar is a higher height of cut, but which means when you're intensively maintaining your green, which is a very low height of cut, the products that you're putting on the greens also go on the collar. And that those products can accumulate in your collars, which can create collar design, especially growth regulators over time. Mm. So there's a lot of research. A lot of places have said, you know what? And the other issue is too, is the collars are on the edge of the greens, which is up against where there's native soil, which is your clays.
Sure.
And a lot of greens are built on sand base. And so those collars struggle because they are on the edges, just because of different soil profiles that are there. So again, like a lot of people have said, if you can get rid of them, get rid of them. We've been lucky enough here where we have full autonomy with a lot of our decisions. And if we could justify it, you know, we do it. And that was the one thing, is we struggled with collars. Some areas thinned really bad, real poorly. And it was crazy because you can see where the collar is, and right next to it, it's the green. And the green's perfect. It's just the collars looks like shit. So we just, you know, this was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. We got rid of collars completely. We scalped them down and they did phenomenal. So what we're going to do this year, though, is because everybody complains, and rightfully so. I mean, these are legit bitches, and I get it, is when your ball rolls and you're up against rough that's cut at 2.5, 3 inches, and how do you – that's an impossible shot.
Sure.
I get it. So I was watching the U.S. Open when it was up at
it feels like you're playing a mini golf, but, you know, when you're playing
up against the woods. Yeah. So what we're going to do, we're going to try this year is I got this idea from U.S. Open a few years ago when it was up at – where was it? Brookline? They had a mower that they would mow their edges of their greens with, and it would drop one side.
Nice.
And just a rotary mower, like your regular lawnmower for your house. So we're going to try that. We're going to drop one side down to maybe an inch. Because that rough is very intensively maintained. It's right up against the green, so it's getting sprayed. It's getting all the good stuff. So we think it'll survive. So that's one thing we're going to do this spring is start taking down. So now that cut of rough that's right around your green, it'll go from an inch, and then you go 21 inches out, and it'll be up to 3 inches or 2.5 inches, whatever we keep our surrounds at. So at least if you roll up against that edge, you could get a putter on it, you get a wedge on it, whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
But it's playable.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the course looks fantastic. I mean, you've done an incredible job out
Thank
here.
You.
And a couple of things to reflect that. Is this right? Revenue has gone up 7 straight years?
Yeah. Actually went up last year too. So that's 8 straight years.
8 straight years.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's not just golf course related though. I mean, that's just everything. I mean, everything we do, you met Kelsey, that's food and beverage with her and what Bree do. And then we have Patrick and what he's capable of doing and the ideas that he has. And then, you know, Pete and Greg and the outings we could bring in. And I mean, that's one thing.
You guys got the Steve Bostoff.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, even with Steve, you know, what he brings in and the focus that he brings from clientele that, early on, especially, Steve's been with us since 2017. I mean, we started talking to him in 2016. I mean, we were a dump.
Yeah.
I mean, I never would have thought we'd attract somebody who's been a top 100 instructor for, you know, 25 plus years in a row. And to be able to bring him in, and then, you know, he has always spoke highly of this place and what we're doing and the clientele that he pulls in because he's, you know, he's teaching them and working with them. And, you know, we've done a lot where now we've attracted a lot of, you know, the members, you know, the Chevy Chases or the Columbias, a lot of their members will come here and play here and love it.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, I think it's Chevy this year where we're their home away from home while they go through their renovation.
Nice.
So they're going to be with us through the summer and the fall. And just, we've worked out something where they're going to come with us and use us as their home away from home. We did the same thing with Bethesda Country Club a few years back. Where we were their home away from home. So
thanks. Chevy Chase is getting a renovation by Andrew Green.
Yeah. So, and Andrew Green's done phenomenal work. Everybody knows what he's done. But you know, that leaves a lot of members without a home, you know, without a place to play golf. And the fact that we can attract them and they want to play here is exciting for us. Cause I mean, it just kind of, it validates a lot of the things that we've done. You know, again, it's just not agronomics. I mean, you could have a great golf course, but if you got shitty people working inside and you don't feel like you're welcome.
Aside from just being, you know, without getting into the economics of that,
what is the
motivation other than just being nice folks? Is it almost like marketing in a way that you've got these folks from a higher end club, private club to come and you can show off your course?
I think it's a genuine feeling genuinely making people feel like they are welcome,
right.
You know, because if you're taking, you know, golf isn't a slow game or a fast game. You know, I mean, you could play in 2 hours, 3 hours, but you know, most people, they know they're giving up a pretty good chunk of their day to come here. And, you know, our approach when people do want to come here and play is, you know, if you're going to spend 4.5 hours, 5 hours, well, why not spend 6?
Yeah.
You know, come get lunch with us. And that's why, you know, Patrick and what Kelsey and what Bree have done, you know, why not spend 7? You know, come earlier, come just hang out. I mean, we have a hell of a view,
mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a lot of things here that are here that we just have to take advantage of. And we do. And a lot of that is just making people feel like they could stay and we'll be the country club for today.
Right.
You know, if you can get away from home and you can come here and spend money and spend your time with us, you know.
What about was last year the first year you had a U.S. Open qualifier?
Yeah, last year.
Do that again this year?
Yes. Yeah, they're back.
What is that? Did the U.S. I imagine USGA sends people over to evaluate?
Well, they work with the MSGA, which is Maryland State Golf Association, and that's the local group. So, you know, we contacted them. We've hosted MSGA events before. 2020, we were actually the first MSGA event after COVID. It was their first event. We had the Women's Championship. It was a 4-day match play event. And that was probably for that event, I would say top three, you know, maybe top five that I've had the course, you know, that when with my plan, with the plan that we put forward, and then, you know, with the way everybody bought into it, and we were able to carry it out. And then we got the US Open qualifier. We heard about that. So I kind of did some research on what we can do and especially preparing grass. It's early May, you know, you're not guaranteed to have a live, you know, grass completely woken up.
Yeah.
And we didn't, you know, we were prepping that Wednesday evening and it snowed, you know, so we had to stop because it didn't snow, but there was ice and the rollers and everything was getting caked with ice. So we had to stop. So again, you're not guaranteed to have great weather, but we put on what I felt. I mean, we've heard a lot. And that's a nice thing with Steve, too, and with everybody who really, again, genuinely cares what people think. Mm-hmm. We had so many great compliments regarding that event. And, you know, so with the changes that we made and with some of the things that we've done, they're coming back this year. And it'll be a little bit different. But, you know, we picked up some extra yardage out there. But for the most part, you know, we're just hoping to have conditions even better than what they were last year.
Nice.
And, they'll be back May 8th this year. Last year was May 4th, and it's a little bit later this year. May 8th.
Very cool. I got a plan. I won't be playing yet, but I got to come out and watch it.
Yeah, come out. I mean, we've had plenty of spectators come out this past year. And one thing that Pete did this past year is, you know, if you play here, you know the blind tee shots. You know, 3, 4, 5, 6. We call it the blind mile. And it's over a mile. I mean, we just kind of coined that recently, so it's not like it's something that's historic. But, you know, it's 3, 4, 5, and 6 is over a mile's worth of golf hole.
Sure.
And every tee shot's blind up over the hill.
Sure.
So, you know, everybody's got difficult holes. All the great clubs and all the great places have a stretch of holes where it's named.
And I would say they're not like crazy blind. I mean,
they're blind.
I guess.
You can see your ball go.
Right.
You see it come down. You might see it bounce.
Yeah.
But you're not going to see where it end up.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
But with that, though, you know, we knew we had that would be a pace issue. Yeah. And when you have 135 guys, 136 guys, however many it was, all trying to qualify for US Open, pace can't be an issue. We got to get through everybody in a day.
Right.
So there was, you know, the eight off 1 and 10. First groups in the morning and then a break and let them play and then another wave in the afternoon. And it was packed.
Yeah.
And so pace really could not be an issue. So Pete did a phenomenal job of organizing spotters. And this goes back to people who just genuinely love PBDI and they were like, hell yeah, we'll be a spotter.
Oh, cool.
So sit out here and watch a bunch of scratch handicap golfers play golf all day. Yep. So we play spotters.
Maybe I'll do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cause we're looking for volunteers now. But yeah, 3, 4, 5, 6, 13, 12 had spotters. We had spotters pretty much on a lot of the holes. Cool. Just to, you know, provide that experience where, you know, guys aren't walking up over the hill, they bounced into the rough, which the rough wasn't crazy, but at least we had it for the guy right away and he'd keep moving instead of looking all over the place.
Do you think, I mean, one of the big kind of, sounds like one of the big ways you guys have been so successful, turn this thing around, is you mentioned everything seemed to be in-house.
And
a lot of public golf courses out here use golf management companies.
Right.
What has been the ownership here's kind of motivation or attitude to keep everything in-house?
Well, it's been, again, going back, same ownership. The person who developed the property, unfortunately, he passed away several years ago. But it stayed in the family. And, you know, the nice thing is we have full autonomy and we kind of take ownership of it anyway, you know, so before it was a management group and it was poor, very poorly, you know, as long as they got their check, you know, that's all that mattered.
Yeah.
You know, so there was no real desire, urgency to improve the place, just keep cutting budgets to make it work. And again, it was the downturn of golf. There were a lot of factors that went into that, but it was just, that's the way it was. Ownership was done with that. So in 2015, they booted the group and it all came in house. And Michael Kim, who you know, helped the owners of this property manage other properties too, the financial side of it and the business development of it. You know, he knew shit about golf, and he'll tell you, I knew nothing about golf. And he just, but there's tons of research out there, and there's tons of information out there. So to bring in an approach that was business oriented rather than golf oriented was, you know, golf is golf, but there's a lot of practices that it, you know, the phrase that we all hate is, well, that's the way it's just always been done. Right. Well, that's bullshit. I mean, you know, when you got a failing business, you can't just say that, you know, and that's something that, when he came in, he really pushed that. And then I came in behind that and I blew up the whole program of everything that was going on and brought in a fresh take. I mean, I kept nothing. I mean, I kept staff. I kept like none of the ideas and plans that were in place going into my first year here. We just started from scratch, which is good because, you know, again, I learned a golf course. So yeah, business wise, that was the thing. It's just having a different approach that was so far outside the box in some ways where you're like, you know, you hope it works. Mm-hmm. And with the right amount of, you know, the right amount of effort, you make it.
You guys have done a great job here. Last question for you.
Sure.
Before it sounds like we're going to head out of the course and, and take some video out there. But this area right here, a lot of folks talk about, you know, really close together. This is probably without argument, like the best kind of little enclave of public golf in the region.
Yeah.
Especially the two that are right up the street between PBDI, Worthington Manor, and Whiskey Creek. I'm just kind of curious, is there any communication between the three? Is there a little rivalry?
I would say it's rivalry. I mean, from my end, our end of our end of everything, the superintendent side, there's no rivalry. It's just we help each other. You know, when we're in the bullshit part of summer, you know, the text threads start flying like, hey, is it going to rain? And I'm kind of like a weather guy. And like a lot of people are texting me like, what's going to happen? And so our side, because again, it goes back to what I said earlier, 100% out of control. So if you're beating yourself up because it hasn't rained and we missed our 10th storm in a row, you can't do that, you know, because that's when you start losing, you know, the mental part of it. You just got to keep grinding. So it's a huge support network on our side of everything. I would say, you know, I mean, you want to do better than the next person, but you never want to hear that you're doing better because the other place is failing or falling apart. So I would say, you know, Rob from Worthington Manor texted me this morning, asked if you could use our air fire because it's going to be air fire and relief. I mean, we share equipment.
Yeah.
You know, we share ideas, we share resources, and it's not. Yeah. It's not like we're trying to sabotage the next person. I promise you,
good.
If Rob listens to this, I'm not going to send it over to you with like Roundup on the wheels or something. No, we just want to see each other do well because, I mean, it's funny you mention that. Like it's a mecca. You know, Chris Moore, who does a lot with bringing golfers. You know, people are coming from all over Mid-Atlantic and Northeast to play golf in the Frederick area.
Yeah.
And you can go up a little further. And I mean, there's great golf courses for whatever budget you've got. And you got Musket Ridge and Maryland National and Glade Valley. I mean, I remember Glade Valley's have made tremendous improvements over the last few years. Yeah. And, you know, you got Clustered Spires, which is owned by the city and Richland, which that's changed names a few times, but there's a lot of good golf right here. And you got the county courses of Maryland, Montgomery County, Little Bennett's 5-minute walk. So, you know, there's a lot of good golf right here, and a lot of people kind of refer to us as like the Ocean City of the West. You know, you could come here in Frederick and you could stay in a hotel and go play phenomenal golf courses.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you don't want to see anybody fail because somebody might come here in the morning and they're going to Worthington Manor in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And then tomorrow morning, they're going to Whiskey Creek and maybe going up to Musket Ridge in the afternoon.
Sure.
So, you know, a lot of places will, you know, a lot of guys will play 36 holes or even more, you know, over the course of a weekend. So, yeah, we're lucky enough that people know they've come here and play a lot of good golf courses. Yeah. And we're happy we fit back in with that again because, you know, for a long time there, it was PBDI may have been the last one on the list, if at all.
Sure.
But, you know, now that we're back and we've done what we've done and a lot of great things coming in the future, there's a lot coming here.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something, you know, we could sit down next year and probably have a totally different conversation with what's going on. So, yeah, good.
That's, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. Anybody that's played it certainly recently. Wouldn't say that now. So I would hope you guys have done great work.
Thank you.
All right, let's wrap it there.
All right.
Chris, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was great. I think we're going to head out on the course.
All right, let's head out.
Cool. I don't have a good golf game, but I don't really care. I'm a regular dude living in D.C., and I want to know about D.C.-centric golf stuff. If you can tell me something that I don't already know, then that is great for me. I don't want the regular stuff. I want exciting stuff. I want different stuff. I want stuff I can't hear elsewhere. But I want it to be about D.C. golf.